From North Carolina to Washington, New York to Hawaii, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, most Americans agree Congress is broken, but there is little agreement on how to fix it. Kevin Porteous of Hillsdale College is here to look at how the nation's legislative branch became dysfunctional. Blue wave, red wave, two waves, no waves. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on the electoral map as voters get ready to head to the polls. More and more voters are registering as independents. Eric Boehm talks with Reason Magazine's Stephanie Slade about the impact of this trend on the midterm elections. And a text message alerted him that his daughters were caught up in the melee around the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Over the years, Congress has ceded more and more of its powers, not only to the executive branch, but to unelected regulators. Here to talk about that trend and why it has contributed to legislative dysfunction is Kevin Porteous of Hillsdale College. Kevin is a professor of politics in the Van Andel Graduate School of Statesmanship, and he is director of American Studies at Hillsdale. Kevin, welcome to American Radio Journal. Kevin, Congress, of course, came into very sharp focus here with the recent confirmation battle over the Supreme Court, and it certainly didn't portray Congress in a good light. I recently saw a poll where 80% of Americans think that the congressional system is broken and needs to be fixed. Of course, everybody has a different idea on what that fix should look like. So first of all, talk for a minute or two about Congress and what is the role that Congress is supposed to fulfill as set out by the framers of our Constitution?
The primary overwhelming, overarching function of Congress in the constitutional system is to make laws. And it's that core function of legislating, that is to say, to make what Madison called in Federalist 62 rules of action. It's that core function that Congress has largely abdicated. We enact, when we do enact laws, we enact these massive, very complicated 1,000 or 2,000 page laws. But when we really dig into them, what we begin to find out is that much of the actual legislating, that is to say, telling people what they have to do in order to be on the right side of the law, as it were, much of that is left up to administrative agencies, judges, cabinet secretaries, and other non-congressional actors. So the Congress really doesn't legislate very much anymore.
When we look at that, you have, as you've pointed out, the situation where Congress passes a law. They leave a lot of the finer points, a lot of the details to essentially what the president has termed the deep state, the bureaucracy. Does anybody really have a handle on or control on this bureaucracy since Congress has given it such wide latitude? Sometimes the president can't even get it under control. Has this actually resulted in the creation of a fourth branch of government here?
In some ways, yes. And we've created what Antonin Scalia once called junior varsity legislatures for every potential legislative policy area under the sun. If we want to have judicial sentencing reform, we establish a sentencing reform commission. If we want clean air, we establish an environmental protection agency, and we empower them. And many of these agencies are headed by commissioners who, under ordinary circumstances, can't be removed as a result of disagreements with the presidents who appointed them or with the successors to the presidents who appointed them. So that, in a very real sense, when it comes to these administrative agencies, elections don't matter all that much, and the courts have told us that explicitly. That is to say, if you want to repeal an onerous piece of regulation, it's not enough just to carry an election. You have to then create, fabricate, manipulate scientific or technical evidence in order to provide a kind of rationalization for your decision to undo the rule. Again, it's not enough just to win an election, and constitutionally, that should be every bit enough. That is to say, if you carry an election, you can pass the laws that you want and have them enforced in the way that you want through the executive branch. But in the administrative state, that's not really the case for a lot of different policy areas.
Is it not normal, Kevin, for whether it be a legislative body, an executive, a bureaucrat, or whatever, usually to try to gather more power unto themselves? It seems in recent decades that Congress has given a lot of its power away. What is driving that? It seems to be unnatural that elected officials would give away their power.
Right. And that's something that one's forced to confront when one realizes that Madison in Federalist 51 says that office holders are going to be jealous of their power because their ambition dictates that they're going to want to gather power into themselves. And I think what's happened in the case of Congress is that when we started transferring legislative power to administrative agencies, now, we began doing this decades ago for pretty decent reasons. That is to say, people began to think that government had become more complicated, life had become more complicated, and so policy should be made by scientific or technical expertise rather than by the people and their well-meaning but amateurish representatives. What happened was, over time, congressmen began to figure out that this system really benefited them. That is to say, they could fulfill their ambition, their desire for position, for prestige, for honor, without having to do their constitutional duty to legislate. And the reason that that's so important is because when congressmen legislate, when they vote on laws, they make friends and they make enemies in terms of supporters and opponents of the bill. And when they want to get reelected, they have to go back to their constituents and say, I did X, Y, and Z, and you should vote for me on this basis. And they have to sort of count up the number of friends they've made, count up the number of enemies they've made through legislating, and then hope that that will come out in the elections in their favor. On the other hand, when they transfer legislative power off to some administrative agency, they can pass very broad laws that effectively say things like, we want clean air, we want safe workplaces, we want quality, affordable health care. And if you are trying to challenge that congressman in an election, how do you do that? Because then that congressman can go and say, oh, my opponent, my challenger, he wants dirty air. He wants unsafe workplaces. He wants people to not have the health care that they need. That's really hard to run against. And so what it means is you can sort of boost your ability to get yourself reelected. On the other hand, who gets left doing all the dirty work? Who gets left making the rules that impose costs, both economic and non-economic, that impose onerous burdens on business and on individual freedom of action? Well, that's the administrative agencies. So congressmen can then turn around and blame administrative agencies for doing the things that the founders wanted Congress to do themselves.
As we look to the outcome of the November general elections, what is likely to occur is both chambers, where party control is almost even, Stephen. Just a couple of seats in favor of one party in the Senate, a couple of seats perhaps in favor of that party or a different one in the House. When you get to a Congress that is evenly divided, how does that impact its ability to function?
One of the things about Congress delegating its legislative authority is I think that it's a bipartisan problem. So you have all the ordinary problems of Congress functioning when the margins are really close, trying to pass laws and cobble majorities together. But those problems are compounded, I think, by the bipartisan problem that nobody really wants to make decisions.
We have been talking with Kevin Porteous, who is a professor of politics in the Van Andel Graduate School of Statesmanship, and he's also director of American Studies at Hillsdale College. Kevin, tell us a bit about Hillsdale.
Hillsdale is a private liberal arts institution in southern Michigan. We also have a program center in Washington, D.C., and probably we are most well known for our rigorous core curriculum in the liberal arts and for our refusal to accept funding from any governmental source, federal or state.
And where can folks go on the web to learn more about Hillsdale and read your writings?
The website for Hillsdale College is www.hillsdale.edu, and there should be a link there that would allow you to see publications from various faculty.
Kevin Porteous of Hillsdale College. Kevin, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Midterm elections, now just days away, and we have Andy Roth at the Club for Growth, and we're going to talk about how to watch the results. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Let's talk about bellwethers. We know, of course, that control of particularly the United States House of Representatives is in play. And what should voters be looking to on Tuesday night early to sort of start to get an idea where this thing is headed?
Obviously, the polls sort of close from East Coast to West Coast. So the place to look first, obviously, are contested races on the East Coast in Virginia. Their polls close at 7 p.m. Eastern. So a couple of races there that will be interesting is Virginia 5 and Virginia 7. I'll speak briefly just about Virginia 7. That's where Dave Bratt, House Freedom Caucus member, represents. And he's going up against a Democrat who's very well-funded, who's very polished, and is very good at evading her positions on the various issues. So it's a very contested race. If Bratt wins that, and right now polling shows him about up 1 or 2 points, then I think Republicans are going to, they're not going to fare really badly. It won't be a huge embarrassing blue wave. So that's the race to watch there. In Virginia 5, Denver Riggleman, it's a similar situation, although I think he's more likely to win than Bratt. So if both of them win, then things are looking pretty good. In Indiana, I know Indiana is more of a Midwest state, but they close at 7 p.m. as well. I would look towards their Senate race. Republican Mike Braun is trying to defeat incumbent Joe Donnelly. Right now, I think Braun is up a few points, and if he can seal that, then I think you can almost put away any idea that the Democrats are going to have just a wonderful, beautiful rout of a night. And then after that, in West Virginia, I think that closes at 7:30 p.m., the West Virginia Senate race. Joe Manchin, the Democrat, is likely to win there. But if Patrick Morrissey, the Republican, wins, then watch out, because then you have what Trump was talking about when it comes to a red wave. So those four seats, Virginia 5 and 7, Indiana Senate, and West Virginia Senate, watch those, and I think that will give you a good indication of how the rest of the night's going to go.
Is it possible, Andy, that we could have somewhat of a red wave, maybe not a big one, but at least a red wave for the U.S. Senate and a blue wave to some degree for the House?
Yes. Well, obviously, both are leaning in the opposite direction. The Senate is leaning in Republicans' direction. The question on everybody's mind is how many seats are the Republicans going to pick up? And the number, I think it's going to be probably 2 or 3, but the number could be anywhere from 0 to 5, I think. So I would watch for that. Then on the House side, unfortunately, I do think that the Republicans are going to lose the majority. The question is whether are the Democrats going to have like a single digit majority, or are they going to have a much larger majority than that? I don't see the blue wave where Republicans just get trounced. So I think they're going to pick up a couple seats in the Senate, and they're going to lose like 30 to 40 seats in the House, which means that the Democrats are going to have anywhere from a 7 to 17 seat lead.
That would actually be somewhat of a split decision, which, as history will tell us, wouldn't be too bad for a president in his first midterm. As we look at that Senate and the possibility of Republican pickups, there's been a significant change in the state of Montana in recent days. John Tester was looking like he was pretty secure, but that race has changed. What happened?
Well, it's worth going back in time a little bit. Montana has historically been a red state or a conservative state. There's a lot of evidence that it's a little bit blue or a little bit purple, but historically it's a red state. So John Tester, the Democrat, he's won twice in Montana, statewide, obviously. But the interesting thing is that he's never gotten 50%, and that's because third-party candidates have gobbled up a few points in each of his elections. And so he got 49% when he was first elected, and then he got 49% again 6 years ago in 2012. All of the polling we've seen shows him at 49% again, and that just seems to be a hard ceiling for him. The Republican, Matt Rosendale, has got 45, 46, 47%, and then the Libertarian gets the whatever's left over. What's notable about all of this is that the Libertarian just this past week came out and said that he was withdrawing from the race and throwing his support behind Matt Rosendale, the Republican. So maybe, just maybe, the Republicans are going to squeak this one out and finally defeat John Tester.
As we look toward possible upsets, Andy, are there states where Democrats are presumed to be likely to win a U.S. Senate seat, but there's an outside shot for the Republican?
Yeah, well, Montana is definitely one of them. Another one might be Florida. Governor Rick Scott is challenging Senator Bill Nelson. That one's so close that Scott could win, and it wouldn't be too much of a surprise. But right now, he is polling behind Nelson and has been consistently polling behind him for a while now. So it'd be a minor surprise. And then Matt Rosendale in Montana would be a surprise. The final one, though, is Bob Huggin in New Jersey. Nobody really knows him. Nobody knows his name. But he's the Republican running against Senator Menendez, who has recently gone through a scandal that appears that he got off on a technicality, or that he was able to avoid any charges. But the Democrats and the liberal newspapers are holding their nose and voting for him anyway. But there might just be enough disgust with him that the Republican wins. The Republican is a former pharmaceutical executive, so he's been spending his own money. And since New Jersey is an expensive state, that's helping make this a competitive race. I suspect Menendez will pull it out, but if the Republican wins, that will be a huge victory, and it will be definitely a shock that people will be amazed at.
As we look at what Republican U.S. senator might lose, does Nevada still rank as the most vulnerable state for Republicans?
Yeah, there are four Republican Senate seats that could lose, but now that we're close to election, Ted Cruz in Texas should be fine. Marsha Blackburn in Tennessee should be fine. Martha McSally in Arizona is just a little bit ahead, so hopefully she's fine. The one that's not quite locked up is Dean Heller in Nevada. He's made a kind of a late surge, and it's possible he could squeak this out. But I think that if any of those races are lost, I think Heller is the one that's most likely to be it. So that's a good race to watch. If he wins, and it'll be very late in the night when we find out, if he wins, then I think that will just expand the Republican majority in the Senate.
Next week, we will talk about all the results. Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, a couple of words about the club.
You bet. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org. And if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, thank you again for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
The number of voters refusing to identify with either major political party is growing. Eric Boehm and Stephanie Slade of Reason Magazine are here to discuss what that means for this week's election.
There is an election coming up. You may have heard about this, actually. It's going to take place on Tuesday, the 2018 midterms. And regardless of the outcome of individual races on Tuesday or in Tuesday's election, one of the big trends in the American electorate going forward is the fact that we now have more people self-identifying as independents than as either Democrats or Republicans. And that has, as you might guess, important implications, not just in 2018, but for the years to come as well. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Stephanie Slade. She is the managing editor of Reason Magazine. She's a colleague of mine, and she's got a background in polling, so she has some really interesting insights into these bigger electoral trends that are shaping American politics, and we're going to talk about some of that here today. Stephanie, thanks so much for being here and taking some time to be with us on the show.
Happy to be here.
Now, you've got a piece up at Reason.com right now, and in the latest edition of Reason Magazine, the headline is, America has more independence than ever. And then the subhead is, but don't get too excited. So we've got to kind of talk about all of that, unpack that. Before we get into the meaning of all this, though, let's just start with the numbers. America has more independent voters than ever. Tell us a little bit about that data.
Yeah, well, let me just start by clarifying. These numbers that I'm looking at in this piece are actually poll results. They're not registered independent or registered Republican, but if you poll all American adults who are eligible to vote, not necessarily those that are registered or who are going to vote, the percentage of those who say, I'm not Republican, I'm not Democrat, I'm an independent, has been going up pretty consistently, slowly but consistently, for the last, like, 50-plus years. So in 1961, we had like 19 or 20% of the total adult population saying I'm an independent. And in 2015, that hit a peak of 40%. So it doubled in 50 years.
But of course, then you follow that up by saying, well, don't get too excited. And so look, those of us who work at Reason Magazine, we are at the very least small L libertarians, if not big L libertarians. And there is, as this data shows, a growing number of people that are not identifying as Democrats or Republicans. There's a larger pool of voters potentially there that are looking for different political ideas. So why shouldn't libertarians or Greens or anybody who is a supporter of a third party, why shouldn't they get more excited about the prospect of a greater number of voices in the electoral system?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, here's the thesis. The sort of theory is that as people in America grow accustomed to proliferation of cultural choices, both lifestyle choices, consumer choices, all of that, they're sort of getting disgusted with the idea that they have to be a part of this red-blue binary. I have to either be part of this party or that party, and they're my only two choices. And so that people are starting to sort of react against that and consider going a third-party direction. That's the theory. And the data could be used to support that theory. But I think that you should be very careful about drawing that conclusion, because even as we've seen this like consistent uptick in the number of Americans who don't want to identify with one side or the other, we haven't seen a consistent uptick in support for third parties. In 2015, like I said, the number of independents hit a peak at 40% of the population, adult population. 1 year later, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate for president, and Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate for president, together pulled in less than 5% of the electorate, right? So you have this peak number of people who are disgusted with the two-party system according to these numbers. And yet it didn't translate into any kind of exciting results, or at least any kind of sort of, I mean, that actually was the best, I would say, Gary Johnson's result in 2016 was the best that any third party has done in the 21st century, for sure. And even still, it was like 3% total. It didn't come anywhere close to being proportional to the number of people who were calling themselves independents. So I have some thoughts about why that is. One of them is that people are kind of liars. They lie in when they're called by a pollster and asked, which party do you identify with? Very often, people, Americans, we like to think of ourselves as independent thinkers, and we're not beholden to one tribe or the other, and so they say, I'm an independent. But of course, when you're talking on the phone to a pollster, there's no outcome that's riding on your answer. So it's easy to kind of give an answer that is expressive or that makes yourself feel good. When you stick them into the polling station, into the polling booth, and actually ask them to vote on something that's going to have real-world outcomes, very often they chicken out and they end up voting for one of the parties that they think actually has a realistic chance of winning.
We are talking with Stephanie Slade. She's the managing editor of Reason Magazine, and she's the author of a piece in the latest edition of Reason Magazine looking at the growing number of independent voters in America. Just about a minute left here, Stephanie, so I apologize. This is a big question to throw at you at the end here, but I mean, we've seen a number of sort of wave elections in the last decade or so, big swings from Republican to Democrat back to Republican, and now it looks like maybe this year potentially a big wave back towards the Democrats. Is the growing number of independents in the system making those big swings more likely? Is that a function of this growing dissatisfaction with the two major parties?
It could be, but I'm kind of skeptical of that thesis as well, because what you actually find when you dig down, you talk to these independent voters a little more, is that they're actually kind of closeted partisan voters. Like they behave very much like either Republicans or Democrats. You say, are you leaning one way or the other? Most of them are. If you ask them if they voted the same way in previous elections, most of them have. So even if they don't want to identify to the pollster as, say, a Republican, probably they're going to behave like a Republican, and there aren't a whole lot of people out there, as far as we know, that really swing back and forth and back and forth. There are some, but not a whole lot.
Spoken like a true pollster. When the polls get it wrong, it's not that the pollsters were wrong, it's that the voters lied about their preferences to the pollsters. I guess that about sums it up. We are unfortunately out of time for today. Stephanie Slade from Reason Magazine, really fascinating thoughts here. Thanks for taking some time being on the show. And again, that's Stephanie Slade. She's the managing editor of Reason Magazine. Check out her newest piece, America Has More Independents Than Ever. It's up online at Reason.com and in the latest edition of Reason Magazine. And for Reason, I'm Eric Boehm. You can catch us right back here again next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The atrocity at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh got very up close and personal for the family of Dr. Paul Kengor. He recounts the horror of that day on this American Radio Journal commentary.
"Pray for us. I will call you later." That was a text message that we received from our 16-year-old daughter at 10:16 a.m. on Saturday morning as we drove toward Pittsburgh Strip District. My wife called her immediately. "Are you okay? Were you in an accident?" In a hushed voice, my daughter explained that she and our second daughter and three friends, along with an adult friend of ours, were hiding in their van across the street from the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh's Squirrel Hill section. They were there for a Saturday morning retreat at an Opus Dei house. They had arrived at 9:55 a.m. They had initially stopped the van directly across from the synagogue on Shady Avenue, which would have been straight in the line of fire between the police and the shooter. They were planning to hop out and walk to the house. Mercifully, the driver, our friend Susie, decided almost on a whim, a gut feel, she later conceded, to find a parking spot so she could walk the girls inside. Just as she moved to a spot a little further away, police cars began flying in. As a girl struggled to assess the chaos, the police parked sideways in order to use their vehicles as shields for the shootout. The street was instantly closed off. Susie told the girls not to get out. They all sat on the floor of the van and listened and prayed and worried. We received a text message about 20 minutes later. Shortly after we talked to her daughter, Susie and the girls made a careful decision to try to drive a little further away. She did a U-turn and went down the street just enough to pull into a driveway that allowed them to put a few houses and buildings of separation between them, the synagogue, and the gunfire. After nearly an hour of confusion, the girls decided to abandon the van. They dashed across backyards and over fences to meet a relative of Susie who had lived down the street. They could hear gunfire as they dashed. They met Susie's relative in his getaway car. The whole thing was scary. It was also evil, an act of evil against our beloved Jewish brothers and sisters at a peaceful Saturday worship service. And while my loved ones were okay, came away with barely a scratch, the same cannot be said of everyone in that synagogue, of course, 11 of which were murdered. My wife and I, we gave thanks that our loved ones didn't get caught in the crossfire. I imagine, however, that many of the families of the victims are asking why God hadn't protected their loved ones. Well, that's a good question, and it's one of those timeless questions that the Jewish people in particular, and believers of all stripes, have asked since literally the time of Job. It's a mystery why some leave this world in a violent way, seemingly prematurely, while others stay longer in this valley of tears. I have no answer there, though I know that God is the author of life, and God wasn't pulling the trigger in that synagogue. No, that was not an act of benevolence by a loving God. I also feel confident in saying this: the true tree of life is not an earthly one, but an eternal one. This world, unlike the heavenly paradise that we seek, is full of sin and rot. Trees in this world decay and die. Eternal life and perfect bliss is not reachable in this world. It comes in the next. And that might be small consolation to the grieving and hurting loved ones at the Tree of Life Synagogue, but I think it's truly the best that we can say. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengore.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KCBC-AM in Manteca, California, WRQV-FM in Ridgeway, Pennsylvania, along with WRYV-FM in Milroy, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.